depending upon the program. Actually, WNET has this problem. Sometimes we get programs with no audio on 3 and 4, which is normally for either a separate audio program, which usually will have descriptive video service, or DVS, where actually a person is describing the scene for a sightless person. Sometimes the separate audio program is used for Spanish language. And normally, when there's no special stuff going on, it'll have the main audio. So that's usually what we find in New York as to be the problem. But also because you may be, you know, having a somewhat weak signal or a lot of multipath, that the decode on that particular stream might be an issue.
Yeah, when it comes to the...
Yeah. Okay, Eric, that's sort of what I suspected, is that we may have a weak signal, because we're hooked up to the building's master antenna, and we're not certain if the master antenna is actually still there. We have to ask somebody at the condo whether there's actually still a master antenna at the work, on the roof, or whether we're just the coax. So it's entirely possible we have a weak signal. So I'll have to probably see if I can hook it up to rabbit ears or something that I can move around and check. Anyway, Eric, thank you. It's sort of, that sounds to me like the most likely thing, though. I'm not sure what I could do to check and see if there's some problem with the with it locking onto the wrong audio feed. That sounds like a harder thing to check out. Am I right?
Well, let's put it this way. Weak signal will generally show up with blocking in the picture, too. I would more suspect that on channel 10 on that particular receiver, I don't know whether you're using a converter box or a TV set with a decoder in it, but you will find under audio there's the ability to select a main program or special program. And sometimes a lot of receivers will be actually decoding the wrong set of streams. So take a look and see the audio portion of your either set-top box or your receiver.
Okay, to see if I'm accidentally receiving the SAT channel instead of the main audio, maybe push the wrong button on the remote or something like that. Is that what you're suggesting, Eric?
Yeah, I'm suggesting if you have a solid picture and it doesn't break up, chances are you're actually tuned to the wrong audio stream or the wrong audio program, as it's called.
Okay. Pushing the buttons on the remote for SAT and stuff like that to toggle that on and off potentially resolve that problem then? Or is it something that cannot be resolved at the receiver's end?
No, there'll be a set of controls that might be buried in the menu. It might be on a remote control. Depends upon the model and make of the device that you have. But all the receivers generally have the ability to select that.
Okay. All right. We'll try that. See if it's in the menus or see if there's an SAT button on the remote and toggle that and see what happens. I did sort of suspect that was one of the possibilities that we could have a wrong setting there. That's very interesting. All right, Dick and Eric, thanks very much. WB2BXO.
Yeah, I got a question related to this one, Eric, that maybe other people have run into a condition that I'm running into. First of all, I may be the only human being in the town or the village, town of Dix Hills, a section of Huntington, Long Island, that is still watching over-the-air television. Everybody else is on cable or satellite. And the good news is...
That's not so true anymore, Dick.
You're saying there's a few of them in my town. And I go driving around, I don't see any antennas on the roof. And with only an antenna inside the building, even if you're on top of my hill, because we've all got 85-foot high trees here, and it's a dense... You look at an aerial picture of my town, and 80% of the time you can't see the house because the trees are overpowering the house, if you know what I mean. So when you try to get a VHF, UHF signal to all those trees without an antenna on the roof, you ain't going to hack it. I'm using an antenna on the roof. I should be using an antenna on the tower. And as such, the branded Channel 4, let me drop,
Yeah, well, let me just tell you that OIW has had now several hundred calls from Huntington, Comac, and a few other areas, so it leads me to believe that there's more people using antennas or avenues than you might think.
When it comes to watching Channel 21, which is only two towns away, yes, I believe that. When it comes to watching the New York City channels, I don't believe it. I don't think anybody... I've got one of the highest places in the town. That's how I selected the house. And with the antenna on the chimney, the NBC, the branded Channel 4, I get, 80% of the time, but 20% of the time I get it very poorly. 5-2, I get poorly 50% of the time. 9-1, I get poorly 50% of the time. Depending on the state of multipath, I'm getting a broken up picture, I'm getting a low signal strength indication, which is really a bit error rate, but you know what I mean. I notice that as the picture starts breaking up, because of weak signal or multipath, that the sound is usually the first thing that disappears and the picture breaks up later. So the fact that you're not getting sound is a strong indication of a multipath or weak signal. And although I'm getting a strong signal from channel 42, which is branded 42, but it's really channel 6, 54 to 60, because at that lower frequency, multipath is so much easier to happen, and interference from power lines is so much easier to happen, I almost never get that one, good audio and non-broken up pictures, even though I'm getting an extremely strong signal strength. So I'm getting the impression that the way digital television works on many converters, mine's a Radio Shack external converter, that loss of sound tends to be first, breakup of picture is second, as you're slowly getting a weaker or more multipath signal. I wonder if you've seen evidence along those lines. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'll go with you on that. You got to understand that the sound and picture, of course, are not in separate RF portions of the spectrum. You know, this is like your Ethernet, okay? Some packets deal with video, some packets deal with audio, some packets deal with the ability to decode. For example, you have an IP address in your computer, and that identifies your receiving and transmitting station. So if somebody's sending data to you, you're on a multiple thing, and things that are addressed to you specifically, or once you get decoded, you don't decode the other traffic that happens to be there. It's a similar type of system. Multipath, if it just happens to be sitting at just the right place for just the right moment, may cause an error in decoding a particular group of packets. But the interesting thing about digital television is it's not consistent. It's not like I have 10 packets of video and I have 12 packets of audio that always occur at the same time. Because the video is MPEG in nature, sometimes it has to send 100 packets to represent a picture, and sometimes it only has to send 10 packets to represent a picture. So, multipath kind of thing, yeah, it's sort of like, oh, you lose the sound. It stops decoding for a second, and depending upon how long it takes for you to receive it, recover, and its clock starts syncing up again to the signal is coming, will have the effect of you lose the sound for a moment, even though the picture is moving along just fine. One thing that we tend to forget is that, yes, you have a clock that has a clock that's going on. Let me drop for a second. You've got a clock that's going tick-tock, 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 and that main clock is considered to be the transport stream. But embedded within the transport stream, there's a video clock, there's an audio clock, there's a data clock, and those occur at different times, so the code circuitry has to find those embedded in the mainstream, so now you kind of get a sense of why some of the stuff can get mixed up, so to speak. K2RIW, K2DX.
Okay, thank you very much. Got a little bit more of understanding what's going on there, Eric. And for those who are doing over-the-air television reception of digital television, one of the things that Joe, the B2RYY, and others have discovered is that if your antenna has a rotator on it, even if it doesn't have fantastic altitude, but if you're using an outdoor television receiving antenna and you put a rotator on it, most of the time you can rotate to a direction where the multipath gets better or the co-channel interference. In my case, I'm getting channel 3. I'm getting channels from Hartford, Connecticut, that are over the horizon, that are not over the horizon for me. I have almost visual sighting, so to speak, of Hartford from my QTH, so they give me grief. And so if I could juggle the azimuth of the antenna back and forth a little bit with a rotator, from time to time I'd be able to steer one of those antenna nulls toward Hartford and one of the peaks toward New York City, and I'd get much better reception. People who have done that experiment have seen that. The need for antenna rotation is considerably greater with over-the-air digital television reception, seems to be what people are discovering. And analog never had that much of a need. I mean, if I had a co-channel interference coming from another location, you'd see a little bit of a ghost in the background with analog. And digital, for the most part, cannot tolerate that, is one way of looking at it. Okay, this let me drop into APG.
Well, I have a little additional tidbit.
Well, let me find Dave first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Dave. Dave, you got it.
Hi, Dick. Can I ask a quick digital TV question?
We're sort of on that subject. We're trying to get back at 9 o'clock to the mailbag, but go ahead.
Okay, thanks, N2APG. On my converter box, when I scan through the channels, originally they all went from low to high in numerical order. Now, when I scan through the channels, it goes from 2.1, it goes to 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, then it jumps to 5.2, and then it goes to 5.1. And I'm wondering what happened, because I believe initially it went up to 5.1, and then it went to 5.2 in numerical order. But now, 5.2 is lower than 5.1, and I just scratching my head on that. I have no idea why that is.
Are you familiar with the fact that 5.2 and 5.1 are on a different RF frequency? Over to you, Dave.
Yes, I believe they're on a different frequency, but I was under the impression that, you know, that 5.1 would be first and then 5.2 would be second.
I'm guessing that your converter is scanning linearly in frequency, and I think the frequency of 5.2 is lower than 5.1.
38 comes first, which is 5.2, and then 44 comes next, which is 5.1.
Yeah, go ahead. You can answer. Thank you very much. And to APG.
Yeah, it seems to be scanning linearly in frequency. And Eric wanted to make some comments. Wait for the beep. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, the one thing that I was going to mention is that, I don't remember who it was, but they were seeing these scallopings on channel 28, 38, 33, and, a couple more. And on the other channels, they don't see the scalloping. You remember that issue, Dick?
Yeah, do you have a comment about that scalloping? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, the scalloping is coming from the CBS antenna, and the CBS antenna is the one with the backfill antenna. And it's the backfill antenna that's causing the cancellation, causing the scalloping.
In your opinion, is that aggravating my Channel 4 brand reception? Is that part of the multipath I'm getting out here in Huntington? Or do you think it's more co-channel interference from Hartford?
Nah, it's the scalloping that's making you nuts. The receiver's decoded, but they don't like it.
In other words, they'd like to have a completely flat spectrum. In other words, that Bart's head, when you look at it on the spectrum analyzer, a digital signal looks like Bart's head. It's a whole bunch of flat-top grass. And I think you're saying that the decoder would like to have equal emphasis of all of those frequencies across the 6-meg channel. And if there are suck-outs in there, it has a lot of grief of filling in the missing info. Is that approximately it, Eric?
Yeah, it is. For those that are in the grade 80 area, the receivers don't really give a damn. But as you move further away, and you get into what approaches the grade Bs, well, actually, if you go a little further out from you, people can't even decode it because of it. And, of course, they don't want to do anything about it because they're more concerned about Brooklyn.
It makes sense. Do you have a guess, Eric, as to what percentage of the viewing audience is using over-the-air reception as opposed to non-over-the-air reception, that includes satellite and cable? And if you gave an answer for Queens, you'd get one answer, Brooklyn, you'd get one answer, Nassau, you'd get one answer. You've got a guess. In other words, in the metro areas like Brooklyn, where smell is, are they 50-50, and it rapidly decreases down to only 10% over the air in Queens and 2% over the air when it comes to where I live out here in the wilds of Suffolk. You got to guess along those lines. Has anyone ever made a map showing percentage of over-the-air reception versus location or distance from the New York City Center? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, there's a couple of clues that'll help you figure it out. The subscribership to cable, and as you know, your cable vision bill keeps going up, and satellite has decreased in the New York metropolitan area in the order of half a million over the past couple of years. And the reason why, and also if you check with Radio Shack, you'll find out that they've sold a heck of a lot more antennas than they ever expected to in the metropolitan area. And really, it's being driven by economics more than anything else. And the people who have discovered that there are quite a few over-the-air services. If you're within anywhere near New York City, you don't just get ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, and PIX. There's a whole plethora of multitude of services that you can pick up that really compensate for your lack of cable. So the percentage numbers are actually increasing to a reasonable amount in the New York City, in the Los Angeles area, in the Washington, D.C. area. They actually have the highest number of over-the-air tunings because they have such a large selection of services to choose from. Of course, you don't get HBO and that kind of thing, but people are willing to give that up to pay nothing. So actually, the CEA has an approximation. You go to their website, they'll give you more exact numbers than I can give you. K2RW,
good information. I thank you, Eric. Okay, what you guys are listening to is what I claim is the brand new technical net, which we have the new mode of operation where during the first hour or so, which,
by the way, congratulations, it worked very well.
Yeah, and you're the guy that finally got through to me. Various people have been saying it for some time, but I was a little bit too insular. This is the brand new technical net where during the first hour we try to handle everybody who signs in with relatively brief questions. We try to keep them brief on the answer so that we get to each of the people so that the poor guy doesn't have to wait for 2 hours. What has apparently been happening is that some people will sign in at the 3 minutes after 8 o'clock, and we don't finally get around to them until 10 o'clock at night. And the poor guy, he's got to go to work the next day, and he can't do that. So we intend to keep doing it this way until somebody gives us a better suggestion. We're adaptable. So quick questions during the first hour. The very next thing is the Mel's mailbag. After that, Paul's space report, if he has one. And then we go into the deeper questions for the rest of the evening. K2KEY, what kind of mail you been getting this week, Mel? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening again. This is K2KEY. First of all, I get 47 channels on my converter box. My antenna is in the attic. That's where it's been always since. Yes, I know a lot of people in Brooklyn that are using, well, we had a whole situation here where post senior area is using converter boxes. They just don't have the wherewithal to pay these ridiculous cable bills, and also there's a lot of popularity with it. People are crying the blues that, you know, I'm short money, I think. I says, well, why don't you get rid of the cable? I said 47 channels is enough. I can say 3/4 of them not even interested in looking at, and there isn't that much on anyhow, so it's more than suffice. Okay, that's comment number one. Then we had a comment about quickly about linear amplifiers, the 900 megahertz linear amplifier range, and I had a couple transistors from similar unit that's used somewhere else, but working on the same frequency called the ST1853 is the transistor. And if I tried taking that transistor down even to 70 centimeters, it don't work well. So in questioning the company that made the transistor, and I compatible to the MRF Motorola series, you just can't shift frequencies that much with those transistors. Those get them to work correctly. So that's what basically is the story on that. Number three, let me see. Okay, you were interested in fractal antennas. real quick. The quad antennas, the fractal, let me let it drop. The fractal antennas, if you're interested more in fractal antennas and my conversations with Chip Cohn, his name is Nathan Cohn, Matt Cohn, but his name he goes by on the air is Chip Cohn. And most of the, a good part of his mathematics came from what was known as the Minkowski, M-I-N-K-O-W-S-K-I, Minkowski, Minkowski Island System. And Minkowski also is responsible for the Minkowski Island Quad. So if you're interested in looking at design, antenna design, based on those mathematics of Benoit Mandelbrot. All right, anyhow, that's that. Next, okay. Let me let it drop and we'll get to the what we should be talking about. Let me recycle it first. And I'll also want to listen for anybody out there not pausing long enough. Let's see if anybody else wants to join us via other means. Go ahead, please, now. I didn't do it. Okay, next. All right, let me look. Here we got some goodies. Okay, first we thank you very much. Last week I was the one that asked you about putting the tube back in a sock with a broken key and took your advice, looked up the filaments and blah, blah, blah. And I also was the one that rewound the dial cord a few weeks ago. Everything worked. And the receiver is working fine. Great. Okay, happy customer. Okay, next one. Let me let it drop. I'm looking. Let me see. Yeah, just give me 1 second to take this one out. Okay. I bought a transceiver, an HF transceiver, and I noticed it gets very hot. Is this really detrimental to its life? And what do you really suggest I do about the heat that seems to develop on the back of the radio and on the cabinet? You know, that's a good question, because surely you've heard this many a time, people putting fans in the back of their ham equipment, which I do. I have a fan that comes on, and, well, some of my stuff really generates heat, but just general overall, what do you think of the situation today with the radio and the problem of getting extremely hot because the cabinets become part of the heat sink, Dick, over.
Now that's a function of design as I see it, Mel. When it comes to portable digital assistant-like devices, cell phones and whatever, people just can't get them small enough. They don't want any external antennas. They want the package to be extremely small. They want the same 1 watt of power output capability so they don't have dropouts when they're driving between their cell sites. And so the package, by definition, has got to give off a certain amount of heat, and it's going to feel hot to the hand. If the manufacturer has done a good design so that there was a fairly low thermal resistance between the sensitive final transistor, per se, as an example, and the outside package, then what you feel as hot, which might be, let me pick a number, 35 degrees C, and it feels uncomfortable to you, the transistor itself, it's well heat sunk. The junction can take 100 degrees C, and in some cases almost 140 degrees C, before any damage takes place. So that would be a safe situation. If, by the other way around, the manufacturer didn't do a good job, if the transistor itself is not well heat sunk to the outside of the package, so the transistor is running, let me pick a number, 70 degrees hotter than the package portion that you touch, and the portion that you touch is 35, and you add the 72, and you end up with 105, then in that case, the exact same feel on the outside of the package would be shortening the life of the device, and then putting a fan in there would help. So, in general, putting in a fan helps. Most devices that have an aging characteristic, extended temperature, accelerated temperature, definitely increases the aging rate. So, doing whatever you can to cool it, to take over for what the manufacturer didn't do a good job because he thinks he's got to supply a small package in order to be saleable, you can help him out, so to speak. So I think there's no fixed answer on this one, but by checking with various guys that have done fan additions and whatever to your particular piece of equipment.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Gee, I think that's the first time I did that tonight. That's a record for me, this long. By checking with the websites where people tell you what they've done in technical correspondence in places like this, you'll find out what's the right way to go. But in general, adding a fan never hurts. I wonder, have you had to add a fan to any of the pieces of equipment you've owned, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yeah, I have added fans to a lot of the new radios because they are hot. I'm just going to tell you that you literally touch the top of the cabinet, and they are getting extremely hot. One that brings to mind is my ICOM 706 Mark IIG, which is a nice radio. It's a terrific compact radio. It goes all the way from 160 to 70 centimeters and works excellent, but it runs kind of hot at its regular if you run it at the higher power. There goes my cell phone. Anyhow, adding a fan seems to help quite a bit. Let me just pick up the phone.
I'm on to Martian. I'm in the Martian.
Yeah, I think a fan can always help. And it's all caused by the fact that we all think we want more compact radios. That's how the no-tune came along. If you really added the Pi network to your amplifier of your final stage of your transmitter, like an Heathkit HW100, the KW, the Collins series or whatever, where they really got a Pi tuning network, maybe one-third of the volume of everything that's in that package is that Pi tuning network. By eliminating it, as long as you can make sure that the antenna is always under a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, you've saved a lot of volume, and people just love small packages. I don't have quite that attitude. When it comes to portable computing devices, like, for instance, my favorite computer these days is a Hewlett-Packard 50, HP 50 handheld calculator. Got all kinds of capability, but by normal standards, it's a little bit bulky. I'm willing to have a bulky calculator if it's got all those other functions. But a lot of people don't think that way. They just can't get the thing small enough, and yet they want full performance when they do that. And you'd be amazed how much you're pushing the state of the art when it comes to the manufacturer supplying that. See if Mel's back. K2KEY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That was just my daughter, Julie, from Jersey, saying she's got good copy on us tonight. All right, so at least we're making it out to that part of Jersey. As I was saying, I have added what I've done. A very easy way to add, and very easy, is very much available. If you look in the computers, as Dick was just talking, regular computers, you'll see that the processor in there runs so goddamn hot that they have a fan on top of the processor. There's a little 12-volt fan. In fact, there's a couple of them in the computer, one in the power supply, and then there's one on the processor. Those little 12-volt fans, you can salvage them from the, junk computers or whatever, or from the power supplies. The power supply one is mostly usually a lot larger. It's a four or six-inch fan, square fan, whereas the one that's on the processor usually is like a one-and-a-half-inch, very small, very compact little fan, and it can really blow a lot of air. And I found that you could put that right on the heat sink very easily to stick it to a heat sink in the back of the radio, plug it into the auxiliary 12-volt output that they usually provide in a radio, and use it to cool down the radio a little bit, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple of comments here that are, some of them are going to be striking. And hello to Julie in New Jersey from K2KEY's offspring. The fans you're talking about are rather inexpensive in the bubble packs at Radio Shack. So buying a fan and adding it to what you believe is the hottest component, the most critical component inside of your radio, an extremely good thing to do. It costs you very little power. There's a 12-volt supply somewhere that'll run your little fan. The fan itself is a brushless DC motor, which has essentially no wear as long as the bearing in there keeps running, and they've got essentially lifetime bearings in there. There's one slight catch to this, and that is, you've added the fan, it's inexpensive, you've cooled the parts inside the radio, the fan itself is quite quiet, and now everything is going to have a hell of a lot more life when you do that. But don't forget about the dust. Your fan is blowing air, it's doing the cooling, but that fan is sucking in slightly dusty air. And so within 6 months or so, there will be a dust buildup, and periodically you should take things apart and get the dust out. Now let me give you an example of what's happening with laptop computers. Let me drop. My son has a fairly modern Lenovo laptop computer, Lenovo brand name. There's a whole series of those things. And it run like a charm for the first year and a half, and then it started getting slower and slower. And he discovered that it only ran slow after it's been on the air a certain period of time, each time he wakes it up, if you know what I mean. With great difficulty, he decided to take it apart, and he found a hell of a lot of dust inside that had been sucked in by its internal fan. He removed the dust, and with difficulty, he put it all back together again, and now it doesn't run slow anymore. There's a heck of a lot of people who have got a laptop computer, and they say, oh, it's old, that's why it's running slow, or I don't have the right updated software. Uh-oh. Turns out that the microprocessor in almost all of our laptop computers has a thermal protect circuit. When it senses the fact that its main junction has gone above some critical temperature, it lowers the amount of heat that it's creating by slowing down the computing rate. And when you start seeing your laptop computer running slower, dust internal could very well be there. I didn't say it's easy, but with the right skill, you take it apart and remove the dust, you can have a hell of a lot more speed out of your laptop computers. You'd be amazed how many people are running into that and don't know about it. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Good. Yes, you're 100% right. I noticed that some of the equipment that has a built-in fan, the air intake port, has a filter, a little piece of material, and it has a tendency to, I guess, clog up over a period of time and cause the airflow to be decreased, and like you say, may then, again, the piece of equipment is going to start to run much warmer. So I guess you got to also check once in a while that situation. But I noticed in the late model computer that, you know, the columns, that they have a very hefty heat sink in there with a fan. The fan is mounted onto a heat sink, which is then mounted onto the processor. So I would assume that making sure that that is in a, you know, set down correctly or clean or whatever it is important, because I could see if that ever, you know, was unclipped. I see it's held by just a clamp. If it's unclamped, then all, I guess that the computer may not have very longevity of stick over.
A1FC.
Go right ahead, Fred.
I was, it brought back memories. I had a situation which I wasn't able to solve. My son is in the computer end of things, figured out. And that is, always check for the firmware upgrade on a laptop. I had one that was overheating and giving me all sorts of trouble. And it turned out that a search revealed that there was a firmware upgrade that solved the problem. So if you have one running slow or acting funny, that's another thing you should always check on. Thank you, Dick. K1FC.
Good suggestion, Fred. You've either got a fairly heavy amount of PL tone, or you've got some 120-cycle hum, maybe because you're holding your microphone near a fluorescent light. So there is a hum-like sound on your signal, Fred. That's about 15 dB weaker than your audio, and therefore quite far above threshold. Maybe you want to know about that. Let's see now. I've got a bunch of other comments on another subject after... I better turn it back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WB2BXO.
Go ahead, Frank, number two.
Okay, first of all, I'm going to let Eric know. My wife went into the audio menus on her TV, and sure enough, that does appear to be the problem so far, is that we had the wrong audio channel. Also, you mentioned that with regards to the current question, the dust in the computer, is this also a problem with the older desktop computers? And would this heating issue slowing down a machine explain why my desktop was absolutely crawling during the hottest part of the summer? Or would that just more likely be a voltage problem with a lot of air conditioners running, etc.? During the summer, it looked like my computer was almost dead in the water, and once the weather started cooling off, it seems to be running reasonably well again. Go ahead.
Dick? Who said that? KA2J. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I close with these guys. That most BIOSes, actually, if you look into the BIOS, you can go under hardware, various different labels for it. You will find a part of it that will actually tell you what the power supply bus voltages are and the operating temperature of the CPU. So if you think you have a problem like that, go into the BIOS, go looking for it, and you'll find it.
Another good suggestion. Frank, number two, I would give a good hard look by disassembling it and look for dust in there. I'm having trouble believing that your voltage being low would do it. Unless your voltage was really low, like below 95, the regulated power supply in most of our computers will give you a constant voltage output. There are certain times of the day and certain times of the year when the internet runs very slow. And so it may be internet speed, not your computer itself. But if your computer is more than a year old, and most of the desktop computers, taking the cover off is fairly easy. Look where the great big microprocessor is with its great big heatsink, quite often with a fan over the top of it, and a simple little wire mechanism holds that fan down. And to go in there with the right kind of a soft brush with a vacuum cleaner and get rid of that dust on the main micro, and while you're at it, to carefully clean up the rest of the PC boards that might have dust. There are times when that can help an awful lot. Can hurt as long as you do it carefully. And these desktop computers are really pretty rugged, is my experience, although I'm using older machines, so maybe I shouldn't talk about the new super compact ones, which maybe don't fall into that category. Any further questions or comments on the subject of dust in a computer and the speed, give us your call letters right now, K2LIW.
I'll give you one more thing.
Go ahead, Eric.
Many of the newer computers are actually using various different kinds of fluid cooling. They will, actually, the Macintoshes, if you ever looked at the Mac, ever since the G5s, they actually use, some of them use water, they use, some of them use isopropyl. They, in essence, pipe the heat away from the CPU and have a condenser unit or another set of pins elsewhere in the computer. And what they've been trying to do is to make the spaces between the pins big enough so it doesn't get clogged up with dust and goo. But the concept of the clock speed going down based on temperature is something that's been around for a very long time. And that's one of the ways to prevent all that high density, because you're talking millions of transistors in a very small space. As to prevent the devices from overheating, and they're very, very rugged, so it's hard to kill them.
So by way of their thermal sensing, thermal self-protect procedure, where they go to a slower computing when they run hot, that quite often is happening. I think you're saying there's a BIOS place where we can find out about that, but keeping everything clean inside is definitely worth doing.
Oh, one more thing.
Heat pipes, by the way, are a very efficient way of dumping heat. A properly designed heat pipe with the right kind of fluid inside can have a thermal resistance that's a very small fraction of a solid chunk of copper of the exact same size. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, one additional thing is just about all computer power supplies are designed to operate in Japan, and in Japan the line voltage is 100 volts.
So I think you're saying low voltage, because you're running air conditioners, is less likely to be a causative agent of what Frank number two is running into. Thermal problems and or something else going on, like a virus. My guess is there are kinds of worms and viruses and other kinds of malware that you can get into your computer that can also slow it down. And you're much more of a computer person than I am, Eric. Is there any easy way that a person can dial into the right section of his computer, so to speak, and find out if malware and viruses and whatever is one of the reasons that this machine is running slow? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Actually, I'd rather defer that question to both either Bernie or Lou, because they have more experience on a wider basis. But then again, you know, I have my issues at work where we have hundreds of machines. But there's not a simple answer to that. Because there's viruses, there's malware, there's other things that corrupt the registry if you're doing Windows and things of that nature. But why don't you pass it on to the guys that do it every day for a living?
Okay. Does anyone knowledgeable on frequency want to address that one? Whether or not there's a doable technique by which you can find out, is my computer running slow because I've got a virus or some other malware? Something else is running in the background, eating up my my CPU time. Is there a way of detecting that? K2LIW on the TechNet. Give me your call letters right now. Yeah, maybe those particular guys are not available. I know we branched off to what you were discussing, Mel. So let's go back to Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW.
I wanted to take a really long break to see if there's anybody on the internet that wants to get in.
That's what we're going to do right now before Mel picks up.
All right, Mel, that's good.
Yeah, that's what I did before. I gave it a long break to see if anybody else wanted to join us. As far as the power supplies go, yes, I've tried that, Dick. I've had quite a number of those power supplies that I've salvaged, taken them apart, used them for different places and all where I needed. Basically, a simple 12-volt power supply to fulfill a certain situation. And in fact, I have a modified one here that's modified more to a Manfred's system. But the part salvaged out of the other power supplies actually became the basis for building it. Yes, I've taken those power supplies, as I was going to say, down to 85 volts, and they still perform exactly the way they're supposed to. So definitely the power supply is not your problem, but other factors can definitely cause your computer to slow down. Like I say, I'm not a so-called maven on computers, so I won't say anymore. Should have asked my daughter. She knows all about that stuff. If she's listening, all right. Not important right now. Let's go on with one more before time is over, Dick. Over.
Ready when you are, Bill.
Okay, here's one that keeps reoccurring also from people. This one here I can sympathize with. I live near the ocean, and the guy wires, the ones that I bought made out of iron guy wires some years ago just rotted away, and the pole bent over. That holds one end of my antenna, my long wire. I was wondering, is there any advantages or disadvantages if I went ahead and I started to use these nylon and synthetic lines on any of my antennas, because it seems like my guy wires don't have any longevity here. Well, I can sympathize with them because I just went through a guy wire changeover in June, which was very costly on the power. I didn't trust those guy wires, and even though I think they may have been only about 10 years old, and yet there was sufficient amount of rust on that steel galvanized guy wire, and it was costly, I'll tell you that. Really, that stuff has gone very, very high. So what I did this time, before I put it up, I coated it with this spar varnish that they use on boats, the metal on boats. It's some kind of epoxy stuff they got now. Supposedly protects the certain parts of the, exposed metal on ships and all. So I gave the guy wires a coating of that, Dick. I'll see if it maybe make them last a little longer. But, this is a current problem, especially with many people that live by the ocean. They'll find that the guy wires have to be inspected more often. You'd be amazed that if you look at the railings by the beach, that surround like the edge of the beach, how they just disappeared, literally. So go ahead, make a comment about guy wires, over.
Yeah, my life heavily depends on the integrity of guy wires of my towers, and as such, I care a lot about them, and I baby them. I definitely recommend that you do not skimp on the price of the guy wires. Buy the quality guy wire that has the known hot-dipped galvanized. I'm a strong advocate of what's called 6M guy wire for my particular towers. 6M is a popular name for it. The utility companies use it. It stands for, 6,000-pound test. I think that's what the 6M stands for. 6,250 pounds, something like that, is the ultimate stress of a cable. 7-stranded, quarter-inch diameter, hot galvanized, dipped, made by Rhone or some other quality company. In a good environment, they may be good for 15 or so years. In a heavy salt spray environment like where you live, yes, you may have to replace them in 10 years. That's the price of doing business. Also, let me drop the hardware that's connected to the guy wire, the guy clips and thimbles and whatever, and eye bolts. You can spray them with cold galvanized spray. It's a Rust-Oleum product, and a few other companies make it. That does an extremely good job of preventing rust. And if only on some particular portion of your guy wire you're getting rust and the rest of it is pretty good, consider spraying it with this cold galvanized spray. It does a beautiful job of preventing rust. But I would not recommend using nylon because, first of all, polypropylene and some of these other cheaper kinds of rope, when exposed to ultraviolet, they turn into powder in about 2 years. Nylon maybe is good for 3-4 years of continuous solar exposure. And there is a kind of nylon rope you can buy that is black in color, which is ultraviolet protected. Let me drop. And the marine supply stores will sell that. And I've used it for guying up some limbs of a tree. And 15 years later, they seem to be in very good shape. So apparently the ultraviolet protected black nylon rope is pretty good stuff. There's also glass line, but the glass line or Kevlar like guy wires, they have an outer black coating to protect them from ultraviolet exposure. And some of these insulated guy wires, I mean, you think you're getting an advantage with insulated. I don't think so. Bear in mind that any place where they install the insulated guy wires, they make sure that the first 20 feet off the ground is made out of steel, and then they flip over to the insulated, because if a range fire occurs and the fire touches the guy wire directly on most of these insulated materials, they will they'll disappear on you. Also, a child walking over there with a razor blade in his hand can do an awful lot of damage and bring down your tower. So for a bunch of reasons, I'm strongly in favor of galvanized steel guy wire, hot tip galvanized. You got to be careful because some of the hardware you can buy, let me drop. Some of the hardware you can buy in a store has only got the 2 molecules thick of electroplated galvanized on them, and they look pretty good at first, but it disappears real fast. Galvanizing, the zinc galvanizing, washes away at a particular rate, so you'd like to have the thickest coating of that you can get, and hot-dip galvanizing can do that for you. So the inexpensive hardware you buy could be a false economy. Because rusting guy clips, because you bought a cheap brand, whether you pay $1 per guy clip or $2 per guy clip, could make a huge difference. Stainless steel hardware, stainless steel eye bolts and U-bolts are definitely worth the investment. You'd like to have stainless steel come in contact with your tower. Make sure that raw steel does not, because the way rusting occurs on a galvanized tower, the galvanized of your tower will sacrifice it to a local piece of cheap steel you've connected, which is rusting away, and your galvanizing will be, you'll literally be stripping the galvanizing off of your tower more rapidly if you put a rusty U-bolt on the tower. So try to make it a heavily galvanized U-bolt and or stainless steel. So inspect them periodically, and the guy wires are extremely important. You can have a zillion pounds of concrete, let me drop. You can have a zillion pounds of concrete at the base of your tower, and you think you're safe. You calculate the bending moment forces you get at the base of the tower, and it'll scare the daylights out of you. The real strength of the tower in a high wind comes from guy wires. Unless your tower looks, if the base of your tower looks like the Eiffel Tower, no problem. Very few of us are willing to do that. We want the tower to be a nice, slim structure. As such, you're getting ridiculous force multiplication at the base if there are no guy wires. Even on a crank-up tower, I would be strongly influenced from my point of view with belt and suspenders. I would be guying at least the bottom section, if not some of the other sections, even on a crank-up tower. And with proper guying of a crank-up tower that's rated for 5 square feet of wind load, and you've added guy wires to it, it may be good for 50 square feet of wind load. Because the guy wires take that horizontal force that wants to buckle your tower, converts it into a pure vertical force, and as long as the rope that the
metal rope that works on the winch that holds up your tower, as long as it is strong enough, or as long as you put the right kind of locking devices into the sections after you've cranked it up, then as long as your tower can tolerate the vertical force, you can get a ridiculous number of multiplication of square feet of tolerance of wind load of your tower if you add guy wires. I've got a Rhone number 6 tower, which is a very chintzy tower by modern standards. But because of the crisscross guying on it, my satellite receiving dish, an 8-foot diameter dish, hanging off the side of that tower at the 60-foot level, went through Hurricane Gloria without damage. The guy wires did that. K2KEY, K2KEY.
I have a big tower. KC2QNQ with a comment?
Eric and then Glenn in that order. Eric, I bet you your guy wires are where, that's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? It's whether or not your broadcast tower is going to stay up is really a function of the quality of those guy wires. KE2EJ and the group, K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, don't forget, I'm required to inspect that tower every year. In fact, we inspect it every 3 months. One thing you haven't mentioned, which is really, you really want to do it right and feel as though you've done a good job of it, you should talk those guy wires. And the tension that it's talked is really important, and it's important in terms of not only you talk them, but you talk them evenly. Now, my tower has no base. My tower sits on a ball, meaning if I lose even, well, if I lose a guy wire in the right place, that tower is coming down. So it is actually the guy wires that maintain that tower being vertical. Another thing that we have to do is check and make sure it's plumb every now and then, because guy wires stretch. I have this gizmo, it's a scale, that we actually attach to the guy wire at the buckle joints. Don't forget, we've got these shoehorns that go into a big clump of cement to hold them in place. And we actually have to talk the first level of guy wires to 4,750 pounds. This is a considerable amount of force, but even with that force, you can still see the guy wires sagging because of the long length. Oh, and another suggestion for keeping things from rusting, and of course you don't want dissimilar metal, but if you go to any Home Depot these days, you can get UV-cured silicone seal, which they guarantee will not degrade for 30 years from ultraviolet light, which is really good. I mean, I used the other stuff that before that, and like every 5 years or every 10 years, I've got to peel them off. And of course, the screws look like they're brand new underneath it and put more stuff on it. But it's a good way to go. K2RIW, KE2J.
Have you ever used any of these substances that look like coaxial? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I've used coaxial. I like it. It gets grippy and brittle and stuff like that after a whole number of years. I mean, when you put it on, it does a great job keeping the water out, keeping everything nice and sealed. But I find the silicone does a much better job. You know, it's bathtub sealer. But you get the stuff made for outside with the anti-UV stuff in it, and you're good to go for 20, 30 years.
W2SCW.
SCW, we're recognized. And you're after Glenn. But Eric, first, the question is, do you happen to know the model number of this ultraviolet-protected, what is it now, room temperature, RTV-like substance? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, actually, GE has a series of them that was called GE Outdoor, GE1. Yeah, you can get them at Home Depot, and DAP has them. It's fairly common. All you got to do is read the tube.
Okay, the next person in line was Glenn, KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, actually, that RTV, they have an RTV black that comes for basically outdoor sealing of windows that you can buy in any, like, Home Depot or Ace Hardware. And it's basically just a black silicone for sealing windows. And you know, don't confuse that with some of the other. They have other some like paste type of stuff that comes in the tube too. But if as long as it says GE silicone on it, and it'll usually show that it has UV protection on it. I just wanted to make a quick comment about some of the ropes that you were talking about earlier. Before you were talking about the steel guy wires, about you were talking about nylon versus Dacron, and the nylon ropes are really, really nasty to try to use for to try to hold up any kind of a structure, mainly because nylon stretches terribly. You know, you could tie it today, and tomorrow it would be completely loose. That's how much stretch you get in nylon. Dacron is a little bit better, but there again, it also stretches as well. You know, for hanging guy wires, it's really, the Dacron isn't too bad, but I don't think I'd really want to use nylon for just about any antenna application at all. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm in from Frank 1. Okay, Frank number 1 is on the list after Jerry. Thank you, Glenn. W2SCW, Jerry at the mic. Go right ahead, Jerry.
Okay, gentlemen, W2SCW, this is Jerry at the mic. Good evening, one and all. I was reading the mail here. I have a Roan tower with a Mosley TA-33, about 34, 35 years up there. And what I did when I put the antenna up, me and five other guys years ago, I coated it with the spray that Roan tower supplied. I coated the antenna radials itself and the connections, and it's held up pretty good. It looks brand new, believe it or not. As far as the guy wire is concerned, get a good enamel spray paint and spray all your connections on the guy wires, and they hold up pretty good. That's what I've done, and it's held up pretty good over the years. I check it once a year, and by golly, they're pretty good. I have 8 guy wires on the tower. This is W2SCW, Jerry at the mic, back to net control.
Very fine, Jerry. I'm a strong believer in cold galvanized, even better than some of the enamels. But there are some more exotic epoxy-like paint these days, which are called rust conversion paints. I think they're kind of homely-looking brown paints, but I hear tell that they do an excellent job of taking rusty areas, converting it back into a good metal, so to speak, once you paint it with these exotic paints. Let's see what Frank number 1's got to say. And what's holding up your towers, Frank? N2RSO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No towers here. I'm using LIPA's utility poles for a rhombic and plain steel masts for the verticals. My comment is really a follow-up to what Glenn had to say about nylon and Dacron ropes. Dacron, it's interesting. I have I've got an old-fashioned clothesline in my backyard that I put up back in the 70s. I've had to change the regular clothesline rope every 2 years, and then finally I found a fairly substantial length of Dacron material. I think it was at the old Pergamon store. Let me drop it a second. It's basically a white-colored Dacron with red diamonds in it. Those of you who may have purchased this at Pergamon. And it's been my clothesline for over 30 years. It has not been affected by ultraviolet rays of the sun at all. However, as Glenn mentioned, it stretches. Not as badly as nylon, but the sagging effect on the clothesline seems to occur right after a rainfall. The more rain that gets in, the lower it sags. When the sun comes out, it gets tight as a drum. My suggestion, if someone really wants to use rope, it's a little more expensive, go with the Kevlar with an outer coating of Dacron. The outer Dacron will protect from ultraviolet, and the Kevlar has a tensile strength that will hold up a tower probably for decades. That's my advice. Probably 3/16 or a quarter inch at the most Kevlar should hold up just about anything. Back to that in 2 hours.
Comment, Dick. John recognized. Now, Kevlar with a Dacron coating is a nice, strong guy wire when you think you need insulated. And I'm convinced that 95% of the time when a person thinks he needs an insulated guy wire, he doesn't. And I still worry about the fact that the Dacron covered Kevlar, as strong as it is, a simple person walking over there with a razor blade can bring the tower down. Or a fire. It can't survive fire and